Set the recording. Recording in progress. And share screen is the last piece. Everybody see, why is that here? That's weird. It should be here. Sorry, just a lot of navigation. Okay. Everybody see the shared screen? We're good? Okay, video on, spotlight on, recording on, checklist, and we're ready to go. Okay, so today we spent the last couple of weeks kind of looking at the background, the story of Yonadav, the conversation, what's going on, leading up to the moment that Amnon finds himself alone with Tamar, and then the rest of the story. I sort of want to pick up tonight a couple of sort of what I would call biblical parallels. In other words, stories that are similar in style and language to the story of Amnon and Tamar. There are a couple in Tanakh, unfortunately. However, each one has both a shared quality or shared language with the story of Amnon and Tamar, but also some profound differences. And as we've discussed a number of times, usually it's the differences that are the most important part of any comparison between two stories. The language parallels kind of direct our attention to events that are similar, and we've already seen or referenced some of those parallels. But at some point, the discussion turns to the highlight of the differences between them. The other piece that I want to, time permitting, share with you this evening is a kind of a separate unit altogether, but an analysis, kind of a psychological or philosophical analysis of the process of Amnon and his transformation from somebody who's described as having loved Tamar to despising her, right? What happened in that moment of the Chet? There is a very famous piece by Rav Soloveitchik that is described in Al HaTshuva, recorded by Rav Pinchas Pelli, that reflects or describes the story of Amnon and Tamar in that fashion. And I thought it would be worthwhile to look at that and go through that. So if you were on our mailing list, if you saw the email that went out early this morning, I did include the two source pages we're going to use tonight attached to that email. So you have it. One is a little bit of a longer text in English. That's the piece from Al HaTshuva we'll get to in a few moments. But I want to start from the text. So let's pick up from Pasuk Yud Aleph. Ategesh elav le'echol. She brings the food in to feed him, because ostensibly she's coming to bring him food. And he takes hold of her and grabs her. Vayomer la, boi shichvi imi achoti. Come lie with me, my sister. Now, the phrase achoti here is interesting. I think I mentioned this before. The word achot has two meanings in this story at this moment. There is the simple understanding of achot, meaning she's a sister or a half-sister or a stepsister. In whatever context, she's certainly described as a achot, and that's certainly in the first pasuk, Avshalom ben David, achot yafa u'shma Tamar, v'yaveh Amnon ben David. Amnon is a full sister, half-sister, stepsister, but sister in the classic sense of the term. But the word achot also means my beloved. Used, for example, in the context of Shir HaShirim as Achoti Kala, my sister, my beloved. And in that context here, this phrase, Shichvi Mi Achoti, is kind of a double entendre. Right? He kind of calls her his sister, but also his sister in the term of endearment. Right? Come to me, my sister. Vatomer lo, Al Achi, no, my brother, Al Taneni, don't force me. Ki lo yaseh kim bi Yisrael, this is not done in Israel. Al taset hanivalazo, don't do this disgraceful thing. Vani ana olichet chepati, where will I carry my shame? Vatati yeke achad hanivalim b'Yisrael, and you will be like one of the disgraced in Israel. Yatad daberna el hamelech kim lo yimna'eni mimeka. Speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. And he refused. He overpowered her, and he forced her, and he lay with her. So there's a number of words, phrases here that describe this act in intensification of it, and it's designed to kind of, as abhorrent and as unusual as this language is for Tanakh, that's part of the reason why it's here. It's Tanakh typically has a very sensitive lashon nekiyah, very kind of simple, sensitive, euphemistic language to describe these things. In this case, the language is much more blunt and intense, and that's intentional. So I'm just going to take care of one little technical thing. Give me 1 second. Sorry about that. Amnon sin'a gdola ma'od, ki gdola sin'a asher sin'a me'ahava asher aheva, v'yomar la Amnon kumi lechi. All of that love, all of that passion that he had is now transformed into a hatred, and the hatred is greater than the love that he had had, to a point where he says to her, get up and leave. Kumi lechi. V'tomar lo, al odot ra'a gdola azot me'acheret asher asita imi l'shalcheni. This wrong that you do now to send me away is worse than what you did before. V'lo ava lishma bokala, but he refused to listen. And she begs him, don't send me away because her life will be in ruin. And he refused to listen. V'ekrat na'aram m'sharto v'yomar shilchuna et zot me'alai achutza. Take this one out. Send this one away. She doesn't even have a name anymore. She's lost even a name, right? Zot, this one. Na'ola delat acharea, lock the door behind. Ve'lektonet pasim kichin tilbashna benot ha'melech ha'btulot me'ilim. She wore this ktonet pasim, tunic of stripes or sleeves. Clear exactly what the words refer to, except for the single reference that it obviously conjures in our minds, which is the story of Yosef, which we'll come back to in a moment. This servant takes it out and bolts the door behind. And at that point, she puts on ashes, she tears her tunic, she's sitting in shame and in mourning, and the rest of the conversation between Avshalom and Tamar and what happens after that, we will come back to. There's a couple of phrases here. V'yomer la Avshalom, ha'iminon achich hayayimach, was your brother Amnon, was he with you? V'ata achoti hacharishi, be silent. Be silent, don't take this to heart. Remain here in, so she remains in Avshalom's house. The king heard these things, he was very angry. And of course, that anger stops there. We've talked about that. And all, Avshalom could not even speak to Amnon because of what he had done. And so he waits 2 years, and at 2 years' time, he turns, they have this big ceremony up in Baal Chatzor. He turns to his servants, and he says, when you see Amnon drunk with wine, Ketov Lev Amnon Bayayin, that'll be a time I'll give you the clue, I'll give you the cue, and you will turn and kill Amnon for what he did to Tamar. That's the second half of the story. And there are, on the face, there are really three stories. So there are, on the face of it, there are two primary stories in Tanakh that carry similar themes, similar language, similar context, although each has a somewhat different ending. One, of course, is the story of Dina and Shechem, Chamor ben Shechem. And the other, which we'll come to tonight, is the story of Yosef and Eshet Potiphar. And both of references hinted to in the text of this parak. There's a third story, but that I'm leaving for another shiur. We'll do that probably either next week or the week after. And that's the comparison to the story of Pelegish Begiva. But I want to, that's a shiur into itself, so we're going to hold on that. But clearly there are some very powerful references to the first two that I mentioned. And so what I've done is I've sort of collected a small chart, which I'm now sharing on the screen. This is the phrase comparison between the story of Tamar and the story of Dina, or a story of comparison of Amnon to Shechem ben Chamor. And the chart's backwards, I apologize for that. The Amnon and Tamar is on the left side of the column, and Dina and the story of Shechem is on the right side. But right away, there are some obvious comparisons and language, the most dramatic of them being a phrase she literally virtually copies and pastes right off the story of Dina. And that is when Tamar says to Amnon, "Vatomer lo al achi, al ta'aneni, ki lo ye'aseh kem b'Yisrael, al ta'aseh ta'nevala zot." This is not done in Israel. Don't do this disgraceful thing. Right? That claim, that response, that don't do this, right? Because this is both a nivala and something which is not done. Those two phrases in the context of this story are exactly the same phrases that are used by Yaakov's children to describe in their minds, or the Torah's description, of what Shechem ben Chamor did to Dina. Bnei Yaakov ba'u min ha-sadeh. I'm assuming everybody's familiar with the basic story. I'm not going to reread it, but we'll see pieces of it. Bnei Yaakov ba'u min ha-sadeh kishom'am. When Yaakov's children heard that Shechem, what he had done to Dina, vayit atzvu ha'anashim vayichal lehem o'od. They gathered together. They were very angry. We'll talk about that phrase in a second. Ki nivala asa b'Yisrael lishkav et bat Yaakov v'chein lo ye'aseh. For this disgraceful thing had been done for the daughter of Yaakov to be shamed in this way, and thus this is not done. And so the phraseology here is extraordinary because it's so pointed, it's so powerful, and it's exactly the moment of Dina being raped by Shechem ben Chamor and Tamar's context with Amnon. The other point of comparison is also in this pasuk, and that is the response. The response here of the, let's say, the broader context, the broader family. They were very angry. David was also very angry, right? David here takes the role of Yaakov, and Yaakov and David take a similar role for two reasons. If you think about the broader context, right, both Yaakov and David are in this moment where the event is happening to their child, in this case, Dina or Tamar, and they're both sort of respond, but don't respond sufficiently. And Yaakov's response is weak because he's waiting for his children to come in from the field. Yaakov shama ki timet Dina bito, uvana vayu et mikneu basadeh. Yaakov heard that Dina was defiled in this way, and he was silent until they would come in, because he couldn't deal with Shechem ben Chamor. He had to wait until the rest of the children could come in, and they would deal with the negotiation with the city. And similarly, with regards to Dina, Yaakov is, David is also in that place where, for reasons we've discussed, he doesn't respond, can't respond, he can be angry, but there isn't an action in terms of his response. And ultimately, who takes responsibility? Who acts to defend Dina's reputation, if you will, or to her integrity, or in case of Tamar, to defend Tamar, right? It's the brother or brothers. It's the siblings, right? It's Avshalom in the case of Amnon and Shimon and Levi in the case of Dina. So you also have that dynamic, the transition of the role of the father and the power struggle amongst the brothers to emerge into that role. That's the backdrop we talked about in terms of Amnon and Avshalom. And that's precisely the same backdrop happening with the story of Yaakov and Yaakov's children. Right? It's subsequent to this event that a whole power struggle with Yosef and his brothers emerges at this point in the Chumash. Similarly, this silence, v'echamish Yaakov ad ba'am, that sense of silence as a response to this crime, is also part of the story by us. V'lo diber Avshalom im Amnon l'merav yatov, that he doesn't speak to Amnon at all. But there's also the phrase, I forgot to put it on the chart, the phrase v'hecharish, that Yaakov was silent, is also part of the story, because that's exactly what Avshalom tells Tamar. He says to her, "Bayomer la Avshalom, me'ata achoti hacharishi." Be silent. I'll deal with it in a sense, but you be silent. In the case of Yaakov, Yaakov was silent, and the brothers stepped in to deal with it. So you have that language parallel also. And unfortunately, this is also part of the story, namely that the revenge that is taken, or the defense, the perpetrator is killed for his actions in a moment of weakness. In other words, not in the moment of strength or negotiation or punishment, but rather by taking advantage of placing them in a compromising position. In the case of Avshalom and Amnon, Avshalom gets Amnon drunk, Ketov Lev Amnon Bayayin, and then he has his servants kill Amnon. And by Shechem ben Hamor, of course, we know that they negotiated a bris milah for the entire community, entire people. And then by Yom HaShlishi, by Yotam Ko'avim, when they were in the third day, when they were experiencing the pain of the circumcision, then they come and they kill Hamor ben Shechem beno, and they take Dina out. So from just structurally and textually, the two stories are very striking, very parallel. But as I said before, the moment I have two stories that are parallel, then what it usually tells me is there's something dramatic that highlights a difference between them. And that difference can be for the letov lera, right? It can be better for one or the other. But there is two very clear, profound differences between the story of Shechem ben Hamor and the story of Amnon and Tamar. Both of them reflect, in the sense, the core of the story, what is the response subsequent to the rape of Dina or of Tamar. The key players here, Shechem ben Hamor in the case of Dina and Amnon in the case of Tamar, each respond or react to the event, to their own chet, to their own actions, in a very different way. In the case of, as we said many times, in the case of Tamar, he's all of his love, that which is described as love, is now transformed into hatred and passion. Vayavea becomes vayanea, becomes vayisnaeha, from love to violating her, to hating her, vayisnaeha Amnon. And therefore, instead of taking a sense of responsibility for his actions, he expels her. And he, Sina Gdola, greater than even the love that he had, and he says to her, Kumi Lechi, get out, go, leave. I don't want to see you again. Lock the door behind you. Right, literally. In other words, everything about his reaction is not only the crime that he's committed, but the subsequent reaction to it is part of the story. In the case of Dinah, the reaction of Shechem ben Hamor is exactly the opposite. Vayarota Shechem ben Hamor achivi nesi haaretz veikachota. Shechem ben Hamor sees her, takes her, vayishkavota vayanea, the same language, he lies with her, he violates her, he overcomes her. And then, that's in Pasuk Bet, and then in Pasuk Gimel, vatidbak nafsho b'dina bat Yaakov. Then he has a real yearning for her and a real connection. Vatidbak nafsho, his soul is connected. Vayaveh et ha'na'ara, and he loves her. In other words, the description of him loving her, vayaveh et ha'na'ara, comes after the act, and therefore it drives a desire to take responsibility, to marry her, to enter into a brit with her. Vayedaber al lev ha'na'ara, he speaks to her, he engages with her. Vayomer Shechem el avia, emtzachen be'enech, ve'alacha, emtzachen be'enechem, harbu alay ma'od moha umatan, ve'etnash kasher tomru elay, tnu li et ha'na'ara l'isha. He wants to marry her fully, legally, with dowry and with everything that's required. Because, number one, because he's really taken by her and fallen for her. And number two, because that's a sense of responsibility. Well, that's precisely what is the exact opposite in the case of Amnon. And the intensity around which that is described is in part because that's part of the story, but also to highlight the distinction between other instances where you have this kind of crime that's perpetrated, but they have the at least the basic decency to turn around and take some level of responsibility for what they've done. Certainly in the case of Shechem and Hamor, it's even a Knanite, right? We're talking about somebody who's completely outside of the domain of the value system of Israelites. But nonetheless, that's at least the basic sense of morality they have. Even that Amnon is lacking, let alone compared to David, who in the aftermath of the events of Bathsheba takes full responsibility for Bathsheba till his dying day. And that's part of the theme that we talked about last year of the consequences of the events of Bathsheba. So in this context, the story really dramatically highlights the evil, if you will, of Amnon. Insult to injury, right? To add to the crime that which even Shechem ben Hamor did not have the chutzpah to do. And so that's one part of the story. The other part of the comparison is to the story of Yosef. And here the comparison is in a different plane altogether. It's the language is very similar. You have Amnon who says to Tamar in a mentioned this before, this expression, which really is so out of the ordinary for the very sensitive and delicate and euphemistic language that Tanakh usually employs, where Amnon says to Tamar, point blank, shichvimi, which is just a very brute expression. The only other person to use such an expression in this context is Eshet Potiphar in her attempt to solicit Yosef. And she says to him, Vatisa Eshet Adonavet Enea El Yosef, she set her eyes on Yosef, Vatomer, Shichvaimi, lie with me. That Canaanite, that Egyptian world, that phraseology that is so sort of maybe expected or maybe ordinary or maybe understandable in the context of Egypt, I wouldn't expect in the context of an Israelite Jewish king, prince of Israel, David HaMelech's son. Yet that's what he says. And so that sort of moment, you stop and think, okay, are we comparing Amnon to Esha Potiphar? Well, at this moment in time, yes. That's exactly what he says. Even the language Liot Ima is similar. Avshalom says to Tamar, has your brother Amnon been with you? Ha'aminon achich haya imach is also a phrase that you find by Yosef. Yosef yom yom liyot ima, to be with her. There's another comparison also with regards to this phrase, to go outside, when Amnon says, send her out, shulchuna zot mi alay achutza, there's this notion that he's inside and she's now being expelled, she's now outside, and that's sort of the same contrast where the palace is the domain of Amnon and Tamar is expelled. Similarly, you have this the palace, if you will, or the house is the domain of Eshet Potiphar, and Yosef runs from it. But unlike Tamar, who is thrown out from it, expelled from it, Yosef leaves it willingly. Vayanos vayetzi achutza. Vayanos achutza. He runs out rather than leaving it being expelled in that way. Of course, the reaction from David and the reaction of Potiphar is similarly described. Kishmoa et kol divesh adonav divesh to shedibay lev lemor kadvarim eila asali avadacha vayichan apo. He was very angry. Of course, the big difference here is that Potiphar heard what Yosef did, but Yosef didn't do anything. But she framed him, right? She lied about him, whereas in the case of Amnon, it is in fact the case that that's exactly what he did do. The most glaring parallel, which is very important for us, is the fact that the Ketonet Pasim is, if I'm not mistaken, is really only referred to in two places in Tanakh. One by Yosef, Yaakov makes for him a Ketonet Pasim. We Yisrael ahavet Yosef, loved Yosef amongst all of his children, and made him a Ketonet Pasim. The word ahav here is actually a very interesting term, because that's part of the story by Amnon also, right? That love is the description of the relationship between Amnon and Tamar, and then it's turned into Sinah. But in the context of Yaakov, it has somewhat of a different meaning. We've talked about the fact that there are certain places in Tanakh where the word Ahava is used, not in the emotional sense of the term, but in the sense of choice, meaning when God describes how he loved Yaakov and he hated Esav, this pasuk in Malachi, Esav li Yaakov, Yaakov and Esav were brothers, hafti etchem, I loved you, hafti et Yaakov et Esav saneti, I loved Yaakov, I hated Esav. Why did God love Yaakov and hate Esav? The simplest explanation is, ahava in this context doesn't refer to a love in an emotional sense, it refers to a relationship, it refers to a choice. God chooses Israel. We say it every morning in the brachas of Kriyat Shema, HaBocher be'amo Yisrael be'ahava. Ata v'chartanu mikol ha'amim, ahavta otanu, we say in the Yontif Davening. Ata bocher and ata ohev, you love and you choose, it's one and the same. When Yaakov demonstrates that he loves Yosef because he was a ben zkunim, it's not saying that he didn't love his other children. When it says that Yaakov loved Rachel, it doesn't mean that he loved Rachel and hated Leah in an emotional sense. It means that to Yaakov, one was the primary wife and the other was a second wife who he hadn't even chosen. He hadn't even desired to marry her and yet was in that context. And so the term Ahava has a specific connotation here of Yaakov choosing Yosef from amongst his children. And therefore, like the crown prince, if you will, gave him a ketonet pasim, because that was a garment that was worn by somebody who was princely, somebody who was demonstrating that they were part of the royal family, or in this case, the chosen melech or ben melech to follow in his father's footsteps. Well, that's exactly the garment that Tamar wore. Because that was a garment that by that point in time was typically worn by princes and princesses, by daughters of the king. It was a garment of a regal garment. And so the context of the Ketanet Pasim is really and she tears it, just like Yosef's garment is torn when the brothers pulled it off him and they dipped it in blood, right? They tore his garment. There's a symbolism there in terms of the tearing of the Malchus away from Yosef and the tearing of the Ketanet Pasim. The other phrase that is very powerful in a different context, but the phrase of Otziu Kol Ish Me'alai, Amnon, who says when he is about to perpetrate his act, he says, everybody out. Otziu Kol Ish Me'alai, I want to be alone with Tamar. That phrase also appears in the context of Yosef, Otziu Kol Ish Me'alai, but the phrase there is in a different connotation altogether. Yosef declares that all of the Egyptians should leave the throne room, if you will, because he's about to reveal himself to his brothers. He couldn't hold back. He wanted to reveal himself to his brothers, but he didn't want to do so in the presence of all of the Egyptians. And so Hotziu Kol Ish Me'alai, he says, everybody out. And Lo Amad Ish Ito Bevitvada Yosef Elachav, so that nobody was there when Yosef could reveal himself to his brothers, in order to protect them from that sense of shame, that he shouldn't embarrass them in public by shaming them in this revelation. So the phrase Otziu Kol Ish Me'alai is exactly the same phrase in both places, but for exactly the opposite reasons. Yosef is protecting his brothers from shame and therefore wants to be alone with them. Amnon wants to shame his sister and therefore wants them to be alone from everybody else. I couldn't have two more opposing moments in contrast to this, to that phrase. And ultimately, the context here speaks for itself. The whole reason to compare Amnon and Tamar to Esha, Potiphar, and Yosef is not to compare two events in which there's a crime that has been committed, like Amnon and Tamar, like Tamar and Dinah. In this case, the comparison is the ability of Yosef to resist that temptation, to control his passions, to say no to Eshet Potiphar. But the roles are reversed here. In this case, it's Eshet Potiphar who is the aggressor and Yosef who is the potential victim and eventually ends up in jail for being framed. But Yosef has the self-control to say no. And Tamar and Amnon does not have the self-control to say no. So the failure of Amnon to the chait that Amnon falls into that abyss is exactly what Yosef is able to protect himself and to avoid going falling into. That contrast is very powerful as well. I'll share with you one additional observation. This is not in the text, so I'll just stop sharing for a second. There's a famous medrash that describes how it is that Yosef was able to withhold that himself and run from that moment of temptation, that what enabled him to explicate himself from the clutches of Eshet Potiphar. So in the language of the medrash, Rashi, I think, quotes in a Chumash, it says that there appeared at that moment, Yosef was very tempted, he came very close to failing, and at that moment when he was about to succumb to that temptation, it appeared to him in a kind of a vision, Dmut Dyukno Shel Aviv, an image of his father sort of in the window. Right? So we have this kind of conjured, our midrashic image of kind of a seeing his father's picture in the reflection in the window. Always reminded me of that scene in the Lion King movie where Simba looks at the puddle of water and he sees a reflection that now that he sees in himself, he sees a little bit of his father. In the context of the Medrash, he sees his father's image and it kind of pulls him back. It's one of those moments where you see the Medrash influenced by the background of the text of Tanakh. Because to introduce to Yosef the image of his father and that which would eventually protect him from the chet is to suggest that Yosef is doing the exact opposite of what Amnon did. Because what did Amnon do? Amnon also saw, you'll forgive me, Dmut Dukno Shel Aviv. He also saw in his mind what he saw as an image of his father. He saw David and Bathsheba. He saw David married to Bathsheba. He saw David having his way with Bathsheba. He saw all of that which the people saw in the story of David and Bathsheba. We've talked about that. And therefore pulled from it all of the negative. Without seeing all of the positive, without seeing the tshuva, without seeing the responsibility, without seeing the conversation between Natan and David, all he saw was the external. And so that dmut, that image, he said, okay, then I can do what I want. If my father could do this, I could do this. And it's that very dmut, it's that very image that empowers him to think that he can do what he wants. So Chazal took Yosef, which is the mirror image of the tzaddik, the righteous person who resists that temptation and says, well, he also must have had that image of his father's strength to presenting to him and holding and protecting him from that moment. The same way Amnon took his father's image and used it to pervert the very moment of that temptation. So it's an extraordinarily insightful medrash, but again, Chazal didn't always put the backdrop to these midrashim into the text. It's sort of left that for us, but by pulling that contrast between Yosef or comparison between Yosef and his father, kind of, and the text leading us to the parallel between Yosef and Amnon, you can kind of complete that circle back to Amnon and David. Okay, I'm going to stop here. That's part one of tonight's shiur. Tonight's shiur is really almost two parts. And take a pause to see if there are any questions on this piece of it first. Questions or comments? No. Okay. That leads us to the second piece of this discussion, which is, you know, the unusual language that is really extraordinary. Let's go back to sharing the screen. It's Pasuk Tetvav. Vayisnea Amnon sinah gdola ma'od ki gdola sinah shesnea mi'ava asher ha'eva. Amnon took all of that love and passion that he had for her, and he transformed it into a hatred, which was now even greater than the love that he had initially. And so all of that passion then gets turned into the evil of those two words, Vayomar la Amnon, kumi lechi. And into that moment, Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, saw a whole analysis of the psychology of the moral failure of anybody who falls into that temptation, but certainly in the case of Amnon, and what should have happened and what did happen. And so I it's so extraordinary. It's worth reading and kind of looking at together. And it's a little bit unusual to kind of work off a text like this. However, I think it's worth the effort. So I'm going to read it I've printed it out and I have it in front of me. It's going to be easier for me to read it that way. It is here on the source page. I will try to kind of keep this on the screen for those who don't have text printed. But the context here is the Rav is addressing the question of the relationship between chet and the impact that it has on a person's soul, a person's neshama. It's a very philosophical piece, but it's very powerful. The Rambam actually has a similar description in his introduction to the commentary, his commentary on Pirkei Avot, with the Rambam, in a famous essay called Eight Chapters, or Shmona Prakim of the Rambam, where he talks about the notion that chet has an impact on our soul, and that the purpose of Pirkei Avot is to kind of guide us to a healthy soul, if you will. So the Rav has a somewhat different approach, but it's similar, but it's based on the same idea. As in sickness of the body, so also in sickness of the soul, which is sin. Man tries to deny, to minimize, and distance himself from the pain. Often out of fear, whether covert or overt, when we are attacked by pains, we often put off a visit to the doctor and console ourselves by saying they're a figment of our imagination, that soon they'll pass. So do we behave with regards to spiritual suffering, which comes to make us aware of sin. In other words, the purpose of feeling bad about a chet is to get us to do something about it. Well, in the same way, when we feel ill, the purpose of the physical ailment is to get us to do something about it, to help heal ourselves. So we have a similar context on a spiritual level with regards to chet. What form does the suffering take to affect the communication of sin to man? So the Rav points to two very powerful psukim, one in the context of the aftermath of Chet HaEgel, and the other in the context of the aftermath of Chet HaMeraglim. And in both places, I'll show you the original text, in Shmot Lamed Gimel, Pasuk Dalet, Vayishma Amat HaDavar HaRazeh Vayitabalu. They heard this evil news that they would be punished for their sins, and they mourned. And they took off their jewelry. Similarly, after Chet HaMeraglim, you find the phrase, Moshe told Bnei Yisrael that they would be punished for their sins, and they mourned. So the Rav picks up on this notion that mourning as a response to Chet is an odd connection. Mourning is when you have a loss of a loved one. Chet is a moral lapse. Where's the connection? So that's what he describes here. In this paragraph, the consciousness of sin reached them and was expressed in the sorrow of mourning. In both of these instances. Why is the sorrow, I'm skipping a paragraph, why is the sorrow of mourning, according to halacha, the laws of, what is the sorrow of mourning? What is this pain of, what is this whole experience? It says, the laws of mourning apply when a person loses something important, something precious. Loss of money and property is not a real loss. A real loss is the loss of somebody who is dear, somebody who's beloved, somebody who's a life partner. Mourning is a reaction to a loss and it expresses itself in a strong sensation of nostalgia, of yearning, of retrospective memories. The power of mourning, its cruelty and its loneliness has its focal point in memory. We remember those who we loved, and that's why we feel the pain of their absence. Were man able to forget, to eradicate events from memory, there'd be no need for mourning. The feelings of bereavement are dependent on memory, which is the greatest blessing of man qua man. Memory constitutes an awareness of the human I. In times of mourning, this blessing, however, becomes a curse because it's the memory that connects us to the person whom we have lost. And so he has this paragraph here, which a very powerful paragraph in which he describes that moment of nostalgia, that moment of a person coming home and finding that everything is normal except the absence, which is abnormal because the person they have loved is no longer there. Mourning engulfs the whole being. It's a very powerful paragraph. You're welcome to read it. This is going to get to the next piece. The sinner also mourns. The sinner also is an avelus. The people mourned. What are they mourning for? So a person who has experiences a loss of a loved one mourns the loss of the person that they loved. What is the sinner mourning? He mourns that which he has irretrievably lost. What is the sinner lost? Everything. The sinner's lost his purity, his holiness, his integrity, spiritual wealth, the joy of life, the spirit of the sanctity of man, all that gives meaning to life and content to human existence. The mourner mourns the soul of the beloved one he has lost. The sinner mourns his own soul, which he has lost. Now, this is very important because this is the key moment, meaning in a healthy context, a person who experiences sin and experiences, therefore, the loss of the integrity of his own soul, if he feels that, it should lead them in a healthy context to recognize their own failings and therefore to do something about it. In an unhealthy context, we'll see what happens with Amnon. Mourning inevitably contains a masochistic element. The mourner tortures, torments themselves. He hates himself. In the bereavement of sin, there's also a clear masochistic element. The sinner begins to sense a feeling of contempt and disgust toward himself, because he is the one to blame, right? He is the one who's committed, who has caused his soul to be tarnished. He experiences this sense of self-hatred. The sin is seen as an abomination, an object of revulsion, something utterly nauseating, the sin. Not the subject of the sin itself. And that's where it's important to distinguish. That feeling generated by sin is not a moral sensation. It's not the moral sense of man that is such a powerful force. The feeling of sin which drags a person to repentance is an aesthetic sensation or a negative one. The sinner feels disgust at the defilement of sin. That's why this association between the concept of chet and tuma. Because you feel dirty, you feel defiled. The suffering of sin lies in the feeling of nausea towards the defiling uncleanliness of the sin. And he quotes from the Chayyadam, a tefillah referred to as Tefillah Zaka, which many have a minute to say on before Yom Kippur. He describes an elderly Jew in the old-fashioned city of Vilna, author of the book of the Chayyadam, many years ago, understood so well the aesthetic opposition a person builds up towards sin. Because in this book, Rav Danzig asks the question of Eicha, how could we have done this? But he says we are astonished at ourselves how this abomination was perpetrated. It doesn't say how did this evil get perpetrated, or the sin, or this iniquity, or this chait, or avon, or pesha, but he calls it an abomination. Because there's an aesthetic moral, an aesthetic character to that description. The sinner is unable to grasp when repentance begins to knock at the door of his heart how he was able to betray the purity of his soul for the abominable sin which now arouses such aesthetic revulsion in his soul. It's not an intellectual process. It's an emotional one. The Torah speaks in the same vein of idolatry. Calls it an abomination. You shall detest it, abhor it. Doesn't say, don't worship idols. It's not an intellectual process. It's a description of, right, if it was an intellectual process, one could have searched for a dispensation to be exempted from the prohibition. It's not the prohibition of idolatry. It's not the prohibition of idolatry that the Torah emphasizes, but the abomination and the revulsion and the ugliness of it. If you have any aesthetic sensitivity whatsoever, if you have a spiritual repulsion for an abomination, how could you possibly be drawn to idolatry? So we are astonished at ourselves, says the Chayyadam. All right. All of that's background to understand his interpretation of what happened to Amnon. Because that's in a healthy context. That's in a human being who we all experience lapses. We all make mistakes. We're all, Ish Tzaddik Ein Ba'aretz Hashi'as HaTov Lo Yachta. There's no such thing as a person who doesn't sin. That's what Yom Kippur is for. And that's what Vidui is about. He doesn't describe that here, but essentially what happens in the process of Vidui is we hold a mirror to ourselves. And we say, well, who's to blame for this revulsion, for this tumah? Me. Right? That's why I articulate it. I become the subject. My soul is tarnished. And through that Vidui, I kind of reflect on it and determine a course or a path to change. That's what David did. Right? Natan held that mirror up to David's face, and David said, Atah Ish, Natan said to him, and David said, Chatati Lasha. Right? That's exactly the moment where the mirror, it's not She made me do it. It's not Adam turning to Chava and saying to God and saying, Chava made me do it, right? The Hishash and Atatali, right? It's Adam saying to God, it's David saying to Natan, okay, I see myself in that mirror, Chatati Lasha. That's what Amnon can't do. So instead, he takes all of that revulsion and all of that defilement, and he externalizes it onto the subject of his act, instead of internalizing, seeing himself in the mirror. And that's what the Rav describes here. In the Bible, we find a story describing how sin turns into abomination, and how the sinner is pursued and chastised not by his weak and helpless desire for the good, but by his aesthetic drive, which proves itself to be powerful, aggressive, and full of cunning. This, of course, is referring to Shmuel Bet. Came to pass after this that Avshalom, son of David, had a fair sister. She was Yafa. She was described as beautiful, whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Now, if Tanakh describes, if the scripture testifies that she was beautiful, that she was fair, we do not doubt that she was indeed beautiful. That's important to know, because he's revolted by her, but not because she's aesthetically not beautiful. Tanakh tells us objectively she was beautiful. And we can imagine how enchanting she was to Amnon, the son of David. A moment before he sinned, Amnon surely thought that Tamar represented a beauty of which there is none higher, none more splendorous or glorious. This filled him with such powerful love that because of it, he sinned and did this base deed as one of the base men. This was a case before the sin. But immediately afterwards, Amnon hated her with a great hatred, for the hatred which he hated her was greater than the love with which he loved her. Meaning, he hated her now with such a great vengeance, not because he suffered pangs of conscience, but because he suddenly realized that not only was she not beautiful, but how ugly and repulsive she was. Now, she wasn't ugly and repulsive objectively, but he took all of that ugliness that was part of the chait, and he's now put that on her. She's become the object of that repulsion. His sin was an abomination to him. But because of it, he came to hate himself and therefore subsequently hated her. That's the masochistic effect. Amnon hated himself and transferred his hatred to Tamar. That's the tragedy of it. Humiliated through no fault of her own. And the same wondrously beautiful Tamar was now transformed in his mind into a symbol of that abomination and that hatred. Amnon certainly did not understand what happened to him. He asked himself the same question that the Chayyadim asked. We are astonished. How could this abomination have been committed? As she had become so hateful and despicable to him, he was not satisfied simply with calling her out and saying, calling to her and saying, go, arise, be gone. Called to his servant boy and said to him, get rid of this woman. Bolt the door behind her. Even the name of Tamar's heart's desire had become an abomination. This woman, unable to form her name on his lips. That's the feeling of abhorrence and defilement that enveloped him, choked him, bolt the door behind her. He felt threatened by her very presence. He so admired her, he so loved her, and now he was filled with such loathing. The sense of bereavement that comes from sin is expressed in the feelings of defilement, loathing, and self-hatred. Remorse is accompanied by bitter self-recrimination. We are astonished at ourselves. We are ashamed. And that sense of shame, again, it all depends on where it goes from there. He has an interesting line here at the end. The awful monstrosity of the act of sin plagues the sinner and leads him to feel remorse. The remorse comes as a result of emotions, not from reasoning. A person's intellect plays a negligible part of it. What was responsible for the transformation which occurred in Amnon's soul turning love into hate? Not the mind, not the intellect. He had no time to reason things out. That was part of the tragedy. Tamar's reaction was logical. Tamar's reaction to him was logical. There's a better path. There's a more kosher path. Talk to my father. We'll work this out. She's appealed. No, but this is, you'll be ashamed. You'll be ashamed. You'll be ashamed. But this is not an act of reason and logic. It's an act of passion. The emotions which came as an instinctive emotional reaction to the sin brought about this transformation. They are natural reactions of revulsion and shame and not processes of reason. And therefore, Amnon couldn't understand why he suddenly hated her to the point that he did. He just knew that he did. You know, it's interesting. I'm going to stop here for a second. If you look at the Avodah of Yom Kippur, right, there's no, the whole context of Yom Kippur revolves around the same idea. Right? Yom Kippur is supposed to be a day of tshuva and a day of tara. Look at the Avodah of Yom Kippur, it's fascinating. Because there's no part of it that's an intellectual process. There's no conversation. There's no dialogue. There's no, okay, let's think about what we've done and have a remorse and have a discussion and do drushes. And it's not part of the common process. Everything about the Avodah of Yom Kippur is about the aesthetics of it. It's about the intensity around the symbolism, about the Si'ul Hashem, the Si'ul Azazel, and it's about sending the goat away, and it's about, it's all ceremony, it's all this, it's all the aesthetics of it. It's all an appeal to the to that drive. And ultimately, that's the moment of Vidui, because in Vidui, we do exactly that. Vidui is a protection. It says at that moment when all of that revulsion and hatred and mourning for that tumah of chet emerges, now you put up a mirror. And now you say, okay, you have no one to blame but yourself. And therefore the process turns inward. Without vidui, that's why the Rambam defines vidui as the central motif, the central mitzvah of tshuva. Without vidui, suddenly it explodes. And where's it going to go? Where's it going to land? It's the famous conversation between Rav Meir and on the pasuk and his wife on the pasuk of Yitamu Chataim in Aretz, where he wanted to pray for the end of the sinners in the community, and she said to him, "It doesn't say Yitamu Chotim in Aretz. It says Yitamu Chataim in Aretz. It doesn't say to destroy the sinner. It says destroy the sin. Right? It's not that." Individual, it's the process. So that's what Amnon can't understand, because he doesn't have that. He never, it's that moment of vidui that David reflects in that mirror and says, Chatati, Amnon can't do it. And so she becomes the object of all of that revulsion and hatred, and he transforms that into really one of the most dramatic psukim in the story. You know, when you think about the concept of the language of ahava, the language of love in Tanakh, and it's used in very different, in several different ways. So we talked about before about the notion of ve'avtat Hashem elokecha, loving God, right? It's about relationship, it's about choice, it's about bechira. This love that Amnon has for Tamar is a very different language. He loved her physically and therefore desired her, right, as we describe. You know, we throw around the word ahava almost casually in a way that's very sort of undermining of its value and of its significance. How many times have you heard the expression, somebody say he loves, you know, I love dinner. I love chicken. I love brisket. I love eating out. I love going to, right? So I once heard one of my teachers once say, "Tohev off." I said, "Yeah, okay. I said, if you don't love chicken, if you love chicken, why would you cook? Why would you shech the chicken, kill the chicken, and eat the chicken? You don't love chicken. You love yourself, and therefore you want to feed that." That desire with something that's tasty, right? The love of an object is because you love yourself. The context of ahava is opposed to engage with another person is not about what they do for me. I love myself and therefore love to feed myself good things or to have good experiences. That's the term in today's world, where love is a physical passion because it's all about feeding the desire because you love yourself. Love in the context of a relationship is about identifying with somebody else. That's the v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, right? To love somebody else like yourself is to identify with them. I think it's with Hirsch who says, I think it's in Chorev, and I have to look that one up, but who explains the root of the word ahava in its correct connotation as derived from the Aramaic word hav, which is to give. It's exact opposite of the way in which we perceive ahava as a function of I love something and therefore I want it. To love something is to give to it, to identify with it, and therefore to give to it. That's why we talk about ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. We give, we sacrifice, we commit ourselves to God. God loves us in the sense that he chooses us, his relationship with us, understands us, engages with us, gives to us. We give to God, ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha. It's a reciprocity. That's the core of a love in the context of a marriage relationship. Think about Yitzchak. Last week's parasha, Yitzchak brings Rivka into his mother's tent. And the pasuk there says, fascinating pasuk. The end of Parashat Chayesara. When Yitzchok first sees Rivka, it's the end of this very long parak of Dalet. He goes out to meditate in the field and he lifts up his eyes and he saw Rivka coming, but she saw Yitzchok, she dismounted from the camel. And who is this? And it says, this is your master, this is my master's son. Yitzchok brought her into the tent of his mother. He marries Rivka. She becomes his wife. And he loved her. He was comforted for his mother. So it's fascinating. Much has been written about the fact that this word, in the context here, is sequentially, in modern terms, out of place. We go through this whole process of dating in order for couples to fall in love and then decide they want to get married, right? Here, Vayavia Yitzka Ka'ola, they get married first. And then Vayavia, says the first, because this context of Ahava is all about giving. You spend a lifetime giving. And therefore you spend a lifetime engaged in this kind of Ahava. Whereas the kind of Ahava that Amnon described, or the Tanakh describes about Amnon, is all about taking. It's all about the physical passion. It's all about he loved the desire. He loved himself, and therefore, to fulfill that desire, he found her the object of that fulfillment. But once that desire has been filled, then the revulsion of the chait overpowers everything else. There's much to, we could spend hours talking about this and kind of unpacking this, but it's a very potent piece from the Rav, and I think it reflects the core, the tenor of the whole story, which is to contrast, even at moments of failure, to contrast David's reaction and ability to rehabilitate himself and Bathsheba and the kingdom and his life compared to the story of Amnon, who sort of sees that moment and then implodes from it. Ultimately, Amnon, Avshalom, Adoniyahu, it's all one tragedy after another. So that's more or less where I wanted to kind of summarize for you. I'll stop here and ask for any comments or questions. Very quiet.
I love the fact that you maintain your enthusiasm or for this class. After all, you taught another class this morning, not the exact same thing.
It's quiet in the morning. There's much more conversation going on in the morning. So sometimes I have to quell the conversation a little bit, you know. But it's okay. It's all good. All right.
It's powerful.
I share that with you. You have the text of the Rosh piece. It's worth, I ran through it quickly, but it's worth the whole chapter, the whole book is really fascinating. It's a collection of summaries of the Rav's famous tshuva drashas, or a selection of them from that piece is there.
Does the Rav write these things in Yiddish and then somebody translates them?
So all the books are different. These are not, the Rav didn't write these. These were lectures that the Rav delivered. Delivered them, of course, in Yiddish. At some point or another, the Rav shifted his language of instruction from Yiddish to English. All the years, I think my parents are still on the call. My father was in his shir, certainly in the days when he spoke in Yiddish. From many of those lectures, there were Tamidim who then recorded them and wrote them down or summarized them, etc. Sometimes with the Rav's blessing and sometimes not, but that's a different dynamic. Over the years, there were certain things that the Rav wrote, and the things that he wrote, depending on where it was printed or what it was, sometimes it was in English, like Lonely Man of Faith, which was a very scholarly article, or sometimes it was in Hebrew, or I don't think the Rav, as far as I know, I don't think the Rav published in Yiddish. I think he published either in Hebrew or in English. And now, of course, there's a legacy and there's a there's much that's being printed, being written by students of the Rav over the years that's a reflection of either of his halachic discourses or of his philosophy presentation, but more personal. All right.
Thank you.
We will adjourn and we will see you all, if not sooner, certainly by next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.